Hello, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, Bill Cannon. I'm a retired NYPD homicide sergeant with just under 27 years. And this is sort of a subsidiary of Police Off the Cuff. And this is my show called Real Crime Stories. And this is the first episode of 2021. So what better way to bring in 2021 to bring in a guest who I've been trying to get for a while. And he's actually an NYPD superstar. And he's known to a lot of people, not just in New York City, but internationally, believe it or not, as a hostage trainer. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome retired NYPD Lieutenant Jack Cambria.
Well, hello there, Bill and audience. And I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's a big honor for me.
You know, Jack, I got your sidekick, James Shanahan, on the show. And I was like, hey, when am I going to get Jack Cambria on? Oh, you know. But I love James. He's a great guy, too. And one day maybe we'll have both of you on. It'll be a real laugh fest. You know?
Yeah, it'll be a roller coaster ride with Jim, for sure. You know, Bill, I first met Jim. I took over the hostage team back in 2001. And I met Jim shortly thereafter, you know, at a training meeting that we were doing. And I recognized the talent in him from that very first meeting. So I latched onto him almost immediately and dragged him into to the hostage world. He became my primary instructor and also, of course, a hostage negotiator. Brilliant.
Yeah, he's a character, too. I mean, that's one of the things why he was such a great teacher is because I taught college for 10 and a half years and I taught at CIC for 6 years at the NYPD. And one of the reasons I think I was a popular instructor was because I injected a lot of humor into the lesson I did, you know, because I remember the guy who taught what I taught previously. He was like watching paint dry, you know, because I took his course in CIC and I won't tell you who it is, but he was boring as all hell. So I said, when I teach this, these guys are going to be laughing, you know, and I think I kept my promise, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's a different audience. You know, cops don't want to be in a training environment. They don't want to be in a classroom. They want to be out playing. So I think I do the same. I learned a lot of my training techniques from James Shanahan. But you have to make it entertaining for them. You have to put on a show, so to speak.
No, absolutely, because they speak the same language. And, you know, cop humor is a certain type of humor, you know. You know, I do stand-up comedy, and sometimes I tell some cop jokes to people that aren't cops, and they're like, hey, that's not funny, you know.
But they have to understand it indeed. But yeah, they're accustomed to going to training classes. And Jim speaks about this. About remember borough based training?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like they go in there and they'd be talking about airborne pathogens or the safe handling of hypodermic needles, you know?
Absolutely.
So when you go in there, as you said, by inserting the humor and relating to their level, it just makes it easy for you and for them. They enjoyable experience.
Well, how many ways did someone use the joke accidental discharge in a sexual manner, right? I mean, come on. To cops, that means a certain thing. You know, you had an accidental discharge at the range, but that's a funny expression.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You can use it in many different ways. So, Jack, I wanted to just get a little background on you. Where'd you grow up?
So I'm a Brooklyn guy. I'm broadcasting to you here from Brooklyn. Brooklyn. Yeah, born and raised. And pretty much worked in Brooklyn. Then I worked other places as well. But
yeah, so did you go from a cop to lieutenant in the 7-2?
So I did, but not consecutively. So my career chronology is very easy to put on paper, Bill, actually. So I was a police officer in the 7-2, so Brooklyn South, Sunset Park section of Brooklyn. And then I got into emergency service after about 5 years or so. And I spent about 5 years also in emergency service, and I got promoted to sergeant, and I went back to the 7-2. I stayed there about 2 years, a little more than 2 years as a sergeant, and then I got invited back to emergency service as a sergeant. And then when I got promoted to lieutenant, back to the 7-2, and then back to ESU as a lieutenant.
But no, Jack, they must have liked you, man, because they kept bringing you back. We would say on this show, we say a guy like that, his balls are dipped in butter, you know?
Oh, I had a job career. Let me tell you about a quick anecdote. So just when I was just about to get promoted to lieutenant, so I'm in emergency service. I worked out of truck 6, which is housed in the 6-8 precinct. But it covered 13 different precincts throughout Brooklyn South. So, of course, the neighboring precinct was the 7-2. So I was like a week away from getting promoted. I already got notified next week, you know, report and so on. So I want to go back to the 7-2 because I know it. I'm comfortable there. And I love the community, and they kind of knew me as well. So I went back to the CO of the 7-2 precinct, a guy named Jimmy LaPedra at the time. He was the deputy inspector. And his sister, I worked with his sister who also worked in the precinct, Deborah LaPedra. Uh-huh. And we worked together in the CPOP unit and the community policing and all of that, right? In the 7-2 and I was a cop. So I went back to him and I said, hey, inspector, you know, I'm going to be promoted next week. The police officer, sergeant here, I'd love to come back as a lieutenant, you know, I'm trying to sell it to him. And he says, no way. What do you mean? No way. He says, I'm going to take you back. And within 2 or 3 months, the issue's going to call you and take you right back.
He's
again.
Right.
He says, well, no, inspector, you know, there's never any guarantee of that. You know. So his sister hears about this. She goes to the brother, says, you better take Jack Cambria back. You know, so he had like no choice, you know. So he takes me back. Well, and sure enough, dollars to donuts. The notification comes in after 2 months. They invited me back to issue as a lieutenant. So now I have to knock on his door, right?
Yeah.
He said, inspector, you got a minute? Yeah, what do you want, Jack? Telephone message just came down going back to ESU. You see me there, Jim?
I want to pull up a great picture of you, Jack.
Oh, okay.
Which says everything.
Got it.
Doesn't that say it all, Jack? Because you can't be a sergeant. You can't be a lieutenant. You can't be a captain without first being a cop.
Right? And, oh, there. That's what you're looking at. Yeah. That's right? At the 7-2. It's in the 7th confines of the 7-2.
And that's a great picture. That says, you know, that says it all. It's like the cop sitting on the stool with the little kid next to him, right?
There you go.
Him breakfast, right?
No, there you go.
I remember when I used to teach college, kids would come up to me and go, I don't want to be a cop. I just want to go straight to homicide. I said, yeah, me too. I wanted that too. But it took me 17 years to get there.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, indeed. So, anyway, just finish the story. So the inspector said, get the fuck out of here. I told you I'm going to kick your ass. He told me. Yeah, you understand, inspector. You know, he was a sergeant in the Staten Island Emergency Service over there. They called it HESI at the time, Highway Emergency Service.
Yeah.
Get out of here. Yeah, indeed. Funny stuff.
You know something, Jack? A lot of people that listen to our show, actually, we have fans all over the world now. They don't know what emergency service is, but they know what SWAT is. And if you say to someone in New York City, oh, you guys are SWAT, and they say, no, we're emergency service. We don't want to be connected with California. That's California shit. We're ESU, ESS, they used to call it Emergency Service Squad. And it's very different because you guys do everything. You don't want to be just known as a SWAT team. Tell people what emergency services role is, what their job
is.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a saying that very popular saying, and all NYPD officers would know about it. And it is when a citizen needs help, they call the police. When the police need help, they call ESU. I love saying that, by the way. But emergency service is a multifunction type of unit, unlike SWAT teams. SWAT teams are exclusively SWAT, the special weapons and tactics. That's all they do. They train, all week long, and hopefully they get that job and they're ready for it. So emergency service does do that. But in emergency service, you'll go from one job of going to a door in a high-risk warrant situation with the helmets, the vest, the machine guns, to the very next job of maybe taking a cat out of a tree.
Right.
It's a very diversified type of unit. It's a high risk rescue unit as well. So someone is contemplating suicide on top of the Brooklyn Bridge, for example. It would be the emergency service unit that would be tasked with climbing up the girder and trying to...
Well, Jack, isn't that part of your training that you have to climb a bridge to the top of the bridge as part of the training? You're not afraid of heights?
No, that's probably a prerequisite. You can't be afraid of heights in order to do that.
I think I would have been like, I never like rooftops or fire escapes. I'd be like, climb down them, but I wouldn't like it, you know?
Yeah. In fact, yeah, guys looking to climb over your back to get up there first, you know?
Yeah, because they want that star, don't you?
There you go. Maybe there's a medal in
it. They want a commendation, so I'm going to climb.
There you go. So, but yeah, that's part of it. And in fact, we used to train on early Sunday mornings. We had a liaison with the MTA, Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, and we'd go up on different bridges early Sunday morning. They'd be nice enough to close one lane off for us so we can train, also photo op as well, right?
Right.
and we'd do that, and just constant practicing. But yeah,
hey, didn't they call truck one the Hollywood truck because those guys always
you got
always
it.
Getting photo ops.
Yeah, that's where the media would hang out. You know, so you know, they don't want to travel to Brooklyn, the news media. So, you know, it's easier for them because that's where they work.
Right.
The jobs in Manhattan, so we used to tease them.
Look, I loved ESU as a sergeant, but even like as an investigative sergeant, a lot of times if you have a shooting, you have to call them there to do the ballistic search.
Sure.
And they used to hate that. Why are we here? Dude, I just got to check a box on the 49 that you were here. Go ahead, go leave. Go climb a bridge, you know? But don't bust my balls. I got to call you here, you know?
And we would get involved also with the more difficult type of searches, so elevator shafts, for example, and sewers and things like that, which are the...
You know, Jack, it took me years to figure out what a triple O elevator was, you know? I was like, what the hell is that? Oh, out of order.
There you go.
If you're housing, you know that day one. I wasn't housing, you know.
There you go. And, of course, when people were stuck in elevators, it was always at the very top floor. You had to climb up 15 stories of your equipment.
You know, I remember one time there was this detective from Manhattan Robbery, and he'll go nameless, but he had a case on the 15th floor, and he was obese, and the elevator was out. You had to see his face, man. I was just like...
Yeah.
All right, just take a floor every 10 minutes. So, you know, don't do them all at once.
You pace yourself. Yeah, indeed. But again, it was an amazing unit. I spent probably in total about 16 years in emergency service in the three.
Jack, that's unbelievable in itself. Yeah. A career, and your career was almost 34 years.
Yeah. Correct.
So 16 of that ESU, which
ESU
is...
ESU in the three ranks. My last 14 were as the commander of the hostage negotiation team. That was another charmed assignment.
We're going to get there. Let's go slowly through your ESU career, because one of the things that people all over the world don't realize, there was two attacks on the World Trade Center, 1993, which was a truck bomb. And of course, we know 2001. And you were at both of them, right?
Yeah, I was, correct.
What was your role in 1993?
So I was a police officer in emergency service, and it was the rescue initially, you know, and they found there were six actual victims in that case that had perished as a result of that. And they were buried deep in the lower floors in the garage areas.
That bomb made a tremendous crater, right, in the building?
It did. And those six that were found mostly in that area. There, pretty much everybody else got out. Thank goodness. And you know, there was no collapse of the actual building, but just, you know, the crater is a great description for what it was. So it was just that. It was just digging through rubble. Of course, all the investigative units were there, ATF and you know, our arson explosion squad and all that. And they came up with a VIN plate of the truck that was used, and that's how. It led to...
And I love the part about the perps going back to get their deposit. I love that. You can't make that shit up, right?
Yeah, you remember that?
You know, Jack, and now they're going to try to stop you from using the word perpetrator. I'd get suspended, I think. I couldn't stop using that word.
This person,
what are you going to call them? A client from the other side? What are you going to call them, remember?
Yeah. I do it. You know, I judge my audience. So the cops, of course, it's perps, you know?
Right.
And with other people, and, you know, the criminals.
The defendant.
The defendant. There you go.
It's crazy shit that the way the vernacular is even changing, you know, that. So in 1993, that bomb was close to bringing the building down too, right?
Yeah, you know, they put it against the main support pillar, you know, so they thought. But of course, there were many main support pillars. So they... you know, they took out one, but that was pretty much it, you know, and caused substantial damage. And it also, you know, changed the way that they dealt with their security issues as well. It was a little easier to get into that tunnel at the time. Anybody that you go in there, maybe pay get a ticket, and then you pay it on the way out. You know?
Well, you know, we learned a lot about security over the years from 9/11 and from other things. I mean, I remember in... you know, I was in anti-crime for 6.5 years, and they used to call these people, these delivery people, creepers. Are you familiar with that term, creeper?
I'm not.
What it was, they used to let delivery guys bring food right up into buildings, And while they were up there, they would help themselves to a woman's pocketbook or, you know, steal this or steal. I mean, when you think about the craziness of just allowing any delivery guy to go right into the any building and deliver food. So that whole policy was changed across the city.
I think it happened in police headquarters once, right? There were like four or five or six computers, you know, laptops went stolen, you know, for somebody that was up there that wasn't supposed to be up there. So, yeah.
I would have loved to have laughed that one off at Comstat, you know? You let headquarters security let five guys come, you know?
Yeah.
Love to see that. Where's the CEO of headquarters security?
I'm sure you heard about that. That is funny.
That is crazy, you know? So now let's just fast forward a little bit to 2001, 9/11. Mm-hmm. Now, you were a lieutenant at that time?
I was. I just got into the hostage team like 5 weeks before. So mid-July, I was in that assignment as the commander of the hostage team. And, of course, September 11th came. So when that happened, Bill Moranz, who was the chief of patrol at the time, he was my CO. He was the CO of SOD, Special Operations Division.
He's a great guy, Bill Moranz.
Oh my God.
I think he has the record of the time he spent in the 2-8 as the CO.
Yeah.
I think he was there for like 5 or 6 years.
19 years as a police officer, as I recall, when he finally passed for sergeant.
I know his son is a lieutenant. I don't know if he's still on the job. He had special victims. I don't know if he's still on the job, though.
Right. Yeah, I remember. I met his son a couple times. So Bill Moranz was the CO of SOD, which is the parent command of the ESU. So I worked under him in that capacity. So he knew me very well. And he might have even been somewhat instrumental in getting me the job with the hostage team, either directly or indirectly. So the day I went for my interview for the hostage negotiation team, my boss at the time was a guy by the name of Jeremiah Quinlan. He was an inspector at the time.
Yeah, I know Quinlan, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I was there in a suit, you know, so he wasn't accustomed to see me in a suit. So, hey, Jack, what are you doing here? This is Bill Moranz. So, no, I'm going for the job. I'm not just, you know, CO, you know, for an interview. So he says to me, you want that? Yeah, it sounds like it's, you know, something, you know, I kind of buy into a little bit in the principles of it. He goes, all right, I'm going to give you a call a little bit later. You still got the same cell number? I said, yeah. He calls me. He goes up to Chief Esposito and he goes, hey, Cambria. And Chief Esposito kind of knew me a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to call the commissioner. So I went up to the commission. So indirectly, he kind of went that way.
Uh-huh.
And I like to think I got it on my own merit, of course. You know, but there might have been.
I think you're talking about the Italian thing. There was some kind of Italian thing going on there.
Actually, yeah, there you go. But either directly or indirectly, at least he helped kind of maybe pave the path a little bit for me.
Well, that's great. That's excellent.
Man, yeah. So the long and short of it, then once I was agreed upon, I had to go, of course, be approved by Chief Ali at the time. May he rest in peace, Chief of Detectives.
I liked Ali.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah. He was a yellow, but
yeah.
I liked him. And then I had to go before I could be approved for it, I had to go before the supervisory board from Internal Affairs. So I said, wait a minute. You know, and nothing, of course, against Internal Affairs.
Cambria, White Sox in 1987.
Yeah. I'm going to go from emergency service citywide lieutenant to Internal Affairs if I don't get this job. So he says, just do it.
Don't worry.
So it kind of went okay for me. So
that's when, for our listeners,
please.
For years, Internal Affairs got not the cream of the crop. They got people that didn't want to do police work. So to rectify that situation, they started forcing the real Popo to go to Internal Affairs to do 2-year stints. And the real Popo were not happy with that. But it was almost like, oh, do your 2 years. And basically they were like, you can have your pickup assignment, which wasn't always true, but that's what they told you. And the theory was that by enforcing this policy, Internal Affairs would get some real cops to work in real investigators.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it worked out or not, but I know a lot of guys that went there that were not happy, you know?
Yeah. I think it did make for a better bureau, though, because you had cops who kind of knew the real deal. And if you were off base, well, then shame on you. But if you weren't, they'd work hard to find that you weren't.
Well, you know, Jack, you see some of like, and both of us did a long time in the police department, and I really didn't witness a lot of corruption. I honestly can say that. But yet, during my time, you had Michael Dowd. You had the mafia cops. I mean, Ippolito and Caracappa. I mean, there was some, they missed some big shit, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's because they were looking for White Sox. I don't know.
I guess, yeah, I guess so. But I agree with you. I never really got up close and personal saw of anything that I would witness.
Right.
But as you said, it did exist. So there,
yeah, obviously. And some of the bigger things they missed, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, that kind of stuff, especially something like Dowd, people had said to myself and Mark DeMayo, why don't you have Dowd on your show? I said, I would not sit in the same room as Dowd.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a piece of shit. He's an alcoholic drug dealer. That he's no cop. I don't want to talk to him about what a gangster he was, because he wasn't a gangster. He was a loser, basically, you know?
Yeah, he was.
So, and I would never speak.
He damaged the reputation of the NYPD, you know? So.
Yeah, he made it hard for every cop that was on the job then and since, you know. You know, look at did you ever watch the documentary, The 7-5?
I did. It's amazing, right?
The part that killed me the most was the transit cop got killed. His name was Venable. He got killed probably by the same people that Dowd was dealing with. And Dowd's on the screen with tears coming down. I took him in the radio car. Dude, you don't get to be a cop now, all right? Don't act like you're a cop now, because a cop got shot and killed by your drug dealer friends, you know?
No, we're on the same page as that, though. No doubt.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
So now, in 2001, you were the head of hostage. You weren't in ESU any longer.
I just got the job like 5 weeks before the attack on the Trade Center. And on that day, so I responded to that, of course. I was scheduled to do a 1-9 that day, 1 in the afternoon to 9 in the evening.
Uh-huh.
And so this happens, you know, started at 8:45, 8:43, I think it was. And in fact, my brother-in-law, who used to live downstairs from me, yells up, Jack, put on the TV. I was getting ready to go to the gym, actually. And I put it on, and I, of course, see what everybody else saw. And then as I'm watching the second building attacks, the second plane rather attacks the building. So I'm trying to call headquarters, where now my office is. And nobody's there. I learned later on that everybody was evacuated out of the building.
Right.
So that would be the next target, right? Cut off the head, you know, of law enforcement, you know, to do that. So finally, I just changed my clothes. I had an unmarked car at the time, a take-home car, Category 1, because of my position. And I drive and I get to the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel at the time, now the U-Carry Tunnel, Memorial Tunnel. And it had just closed because the first building had just collapsed.
Right.
All the debris was like funneling out of the Brooklyn side, papers and everything, heavy smoke, so that was closed. So I made my way to the Brooklyn Bridge. That was closed also, but I was able to get on, you know, with my shield and, of course, with the car. And I get about halfway over the bridge, and all of a sudden I'm met with a flood of people, thousands upon thousands of people walking from Manhattan into Brooklyn on the road where the cars are. So the car was stopped, and I'm trying to kind of get my way through, tooting the siren with the lights on. And I'm about halfway over the bridge now. All of a sudden I hear the screaming on the radio, and I look to the left, and I see the second building.
I watched that too from Canal Street. It's a sight that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
Oh yeah, it was horrifying, right? That was horrifying. And frightened, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I finally, it took me about a half an hour to get over that bridge. It was that slow. And finally make my way over to Vesey Street and the west side. And I have to wind up parking the car like 6 or 7 blocks away.
Which was a smart thing that you did, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and after there's no choice. I mean, there was nowhere to put the car. So I finally stick it somewhere, and I make my way the 6 or 7 blocks, and I wind up seeing one guy that I know, and he was on a bucket brigade. I get on the bucket brigade. I didn't know what else to do. And fortunately, still in my car, I had my filter mask, and the two, you know, breathing apparatus masks. So I put it on, and I had my construction helmet from ASU as well. So I had something, some level of breathing protection at least, because now as we see, so many of our guys.
You know what we were using? We were using those red Bloods bandanas, you know, like they look like the four of us were in the Bloods gang, you know, but there was nothing. There was nothing down there yet, you know, and that's probably when you breathed in the worst shit, those first 12 hours.
Yeah, and as you remember, Bill, you couldn't even see maybe 2 feet in front of your face.
That's, I know, you try to explain that to people, how thick the air was with... Mm-hmm. You couldn't see a thing. Yeah.
That afternoon, finally, Chief Moranis gets in touch with me on my cell phone. And he was the chief of patrol at the time. And he says, Jack, we're taking back all ESU guys who had left because of their, background in rescue and recovery. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, chief, there's no place else I would need to be. Yeah, absolutely. So I was then transferred back to ESU on a temporary assignment at this point. And I remained down at the site almost 3 months. It was about 2.5 months. I left there. Like,
do you get checked all the time? Because that's a long time to be down there.
Yeah, I do. So I do the World Trade Center monitoring.
Yeah, I've been doing that too for I don't know, as long as it's been going on.
Yeah, so I try to stay on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long time to actually be on the site, you know?
Yeah, being down there. So hopefully I had proper protection, which was doing its job. So
yeah,
it's tough times. Yeah, there were tough times. And of course, we all lost so many of our colleagues, friends. And
well, especially you. You were in ESU. Some real great guys from ESU were lost that day.
In fact, two of them, I had, when I was a lieutenant in ESU, part of my responsibilities were to interview new people looking to apply to ESU. And then I would make the recommendation to the CO. And two of them, I gave the nod to. These guys were great. Inspector Watson at the time, Ron Watson. And based on my recommendation, he accepted him into the unit. So I had some, I guess, a little baggage about that.
Yeah.
I should hide these guys, You know how that goes.
You can't second guess yourself, though, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, life shit happens,
That's right.
And there's nothing you can do. So anyway, it's hard to believe that this September is 20 years since 9/11. It's unbelievable that it's 20 years have gone by. And, it seems like some people are trying to push to forget about it, And I was real pissed when they tried to not even have – remember they tried to not have the ceremony this year because of COVID and all of that stuff?
Right, yeah.
You know, and you can't – we can't ever let them get away with not remembering it in the proper way,
Yeah.
If people want to read those names for 50 years, they should be allowed to. All right. So, one thing I want to cover about hostages, and I'm sure you would love this too, is that let's recognize the people that started Hostage. Wasn't there a guy, Captain Frank Bowles, right? Who was the second guy after him?
And, you also have to mention Dr. Harvey Slosberg, who was a detective on our job, who had his PhD in forensic psychology.
Okay.
So a real brief history of it, because it's a little involved, but there were four incidents that the NYPD looked at the time. So before I even get to that, the NYPD hostage negotiation team does have some bragging rights. That is, it is the first hostage negotiation team ever established in the entire world. So it all started in New York City, and it was based on four incidents that had occurred during that time period. The first one was Attica prison riots, as you would remember for sure.
Right. Uh-huh.
1971.
That's when Rockefeller said, take the prison back, right?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a famous picture of Rockefeller giving the middle finger, I won't do it to the audience.
Yeah.
Giving the middle finger in the newspapers, right?
Imagine a politician giving an order like that today.
Oh, no,
like,
no.
Imagine Cuomo would be like, I didn't do it. I didn't say it,
Yeah, exactly.
After the shit went bad.
Right. And that started over, conditions in the facility there, food, all of that, whatever their complaints were. And that's how it all started. And after, I think it was 4 days,
William Kunstler was their attorney.
That's right.
I remember the history,
Yeah. And the end result of that, there was 39 inmates were killed, 10 correction officers, and two other staff members were killed as a result of that. So the NYPD looked at that at the time, but they considered that, it's hundreds of miles from the borders of New York City. It's confined within the walls of a correctional facility. So we know about it.